The End of Iraq. How American Incompetence Created a War Without End. By Peter W. Galbraith. Narrated by Alan Sklar. Copyright 2006 by Peter W. Galbraith. This unabridged audiobook is published by arrangement with Peter W. Galbraith and the Wiley Agency, and was produced in the year 2008 by Tantor Media Incorporated, which holds the copyright thereto. Death Speaks. There was a merchant in Baghdad who sent his servant to market to buy provisions, and in a little while the servant came back, white and trembling, and said, "Master, just now when I was in the marketplace, I was jostled by a woman in the crowd, and when I turned, I saw it was death that jostled me. She looked at me and made a threatening gesture. Now, lend me your horse, and I will ride away from this city and avoid my fate. I will go to Samarra, and there death will not find me." The merchant lent him his horse, and the servant mounted it, and he dug his spurs in its flanks, and as fast as the horse could gallop he went. Then the merchant went down to the marketplace, and he saw me standing in the crowd, and he came to me and said, "Why did you make a threatening gesture to my servant when you saw him this morning?" "That was not a threatening gesture," I said. "It was only a start of surprise. I was astonished to see him in Baghdad, for I had an appointment with him tonight in Samarra." As retold by W. Somerset Maugham, 1933. Bring Them On! George W. Bush, 2003. Chapter 1. The Appointment in Samarra. Iraq's deadliest terrorist attack killed no one. In the early morning hours of February 22, 2006, armed men stormed the Askariya Shrine in Samarra, 60 miles north of Baghdad. They handcuffed the four guards and left them in a side room. Working for several hours, the men placed several hundred pounds of explosives at strategic points under the shrine's golden dome. At 6:55 a.m., they detonated the explosives, probably with a cell phone. The dome collapsed, and a shrine dating back to the 9th century was in ruins. For centuries, Iraq's Shiites brought a saddled horse to the Askariya Shrine. The horse waited for the return of Muhammad al-Mahdi, the 12th and last imam who went into hiding in 878 in a cave under the shrine. Still a child when last seen, the imam communicated with his followers through an intermediary for 70 years before contact ceased. Shiites believe he is still alive. His return will usher in an era of justice to be followed by the judgment day. The powerful caliph of Baghdad, the spiritual head of the rival Sunni branch of Islam, had ordered the Mahdi's grandfather, the 10th imam Ali al-Hadi, brought to Samarra in a kind of house arrest. The Shiites believed that he had Hadi poisoned in 868, and that he ordered Hadi's son, the 11th Imam Hassan al-Askari, killed 6 years later. The faithful hid the 12th Imam to spare him the same fate. Iraq's Shiite majority see the men who destroyed the Askariya shrine as successors to the caliph's assassins, and with good reason. Almost certainly, the shrine was destroyed by al-Qaeda in Mesopotamia, the Iraqi offshoot of the organization that brought down New York's World Trade Center. Al-Qaeda seeks to restore the Sunni caliphate and considers adherence to the Shiite brand of Islam as apostates deserving of death. Within hours of the shrine's destruction, black-clad members of the Mahdi army, a Shiite militia named for the 12th Imam, took control of key points around Baghdad. Shiites then launched attacks on Sunni mosques around Baghdad. Intimidated by the Mahdi army, the Iraqi army and the U.S. military did not intervene. Some Iraqi police, the beneficiaries of a multi-billion-dollar U.S. training program, joined the attackers while others looked on. Three Sunni imams were killed that day in Baghdad. In Basra, a Shiite mob broke into a jail, seized 10 foreign Arabs who had been jailed on suspicion of terrorism, and shot them. The next day, Sunni Arabs pulled 47 Shiites off buses near the mixed Sunni-Shiite city of Bakuba and executed them. In order to keep people away from inflammatory sermons expected at Friday prayers 2 days following the attack, Iraq's Shiite-dominated government imposed a 24-hour curfew on Baghdad. Even so, 29 bodies turned up around the city. The victims had been handcuffed and shot in the head, an indication that they were Sunnis picked up by the police or Shiite militia wearing police uniforms and killed. In the week that followed the Samarra bombing, 184 Sunni mosques were destroyed or vandalized. Sectarian violence killed more than 1,000 Sunnis and Shiites. In predominantly Sunni neighborhoods, vigilantes warned Shiite families to leave, while Sunnis were evicted from Shiite neighborhoods. Those foolish enough to ignore the warnings were killed. Baghdad's mixed neighborhoods became armed camps. Atwar Bahajat, a 30-year-old reporter for Al Arabiya, the Dubai-based Arabic television network, raced from Baghdad to her native Samarra on hearing the first reports of the bombing. 10 minutes after a live broadcast from near the shrine, gunmen abducted her, along with cameraman Khalid Mahmoud Al-Falahi and soundman Adnan Khairallah, and shot them. Atwar Bahajat was born to a Shiite father and a Sunni mother. As if to underscore that there is no place in the new Iraq for Sunnis and Shiites to live together, Sunni gunmen attacked her funeral, killing one mourner and wounding several others. As civil war accelerated, Iraq had only a caretaker government. In December 2005, Iraq had held its third national election within that single calendar year, choosing the country's permanent parliament under the constitution approved by voters the previous October 15th. Intended to cap a year of transition to a new democratic Iraq, the elections served to intensify Iraq's religious and ethnic divisions. Shiites voted for Shiite religious parties, Kurds for Kurdish nationalist parties, and Sunni Arabs for Sunni religious parties or for Sunni Arab nationalists. Fewer than 1 in 10 Iraqis had voted for parties that crossed ethnic or religious lines. Iraq's constitution is intended to foster consensus by requiring a 2/3 majority to form a government. But Iraq's three main communities, the Shiites, the Sunni Arabs, and the Kurds, do not have similar values, a common program, the same allies, nor even a commitment to the continuation of Iraq as a state. After the elections, it took more than 4 months to find sufficient common ground to choose a president, 2 vice presidents, the parliament's speaker and his deputies, and to designate a prime minister, in spite of broad agreement that there should be a government of national unity that represented all three groups. In Iraq's civil war, the United States is in the middle. Sunni Arabs believe the United States delivered Iraq to the Shiites and the Iranians. In the February 2006 pogroms, they blamed the U.S. military for standing aside while Shiites destroyed Sunni mosques. The Shiites accused the United States of having sided with the Sunnis in the period leading up to the attack in Samarra. Abdul Aziz al-Hakim, the leader of Iraq's most influential Shiite party, charged that the American ambassador to Iraq, Zalmay Khalilzad, had given the terrorists a green light when he criticized the human rights record of Iraq's Shiite-led security forces. Shiites refer to Khalilzad, a Sunni Muslim who is a naturalized American originally from Afghanistan, as Abu Omar, a reference to the second Sunni caliph who, in the Shiite view, usurped the legitimate succession to the Prophet in the 7th century. Muqtada al-Sadr, the radical Shiite cleric who leads the Mahdi army, blamed the U.S. for the destruction of the Askariya shrine, saying the Americans were even worse than Saddam. According to al-Sadr, the United States invaded Iraq to assassinate the Mahdi, whose return, the Americans knew, was imminent. As the horrific events unfolded in Samarra and Baghdad, I was staying in the Baghdad headquarters of Kurdistan President Masoud Barzani, putting the finishing touches on this book. Because of the headquarters' central location in Baghdad's fortified Green Zone, Iraq's leaders gathered there to discuss the sectarian fighting and the problems of forming a government. As they discussed the crisis overtaking their country, it was clear they saw it as a civil war, and many used that phrase in their conversations with me. As if to underline the point, 3 9-foot Katyusha rockets landed in close proximity to Barzani's house while I was writing the preceding paragraphs. Fortunately, the closest one, some 20 yards from me, was a dud. Its unexploded warhead burrowed 3 feet into the asphalt of the parking lot, but did no other harm. In contrast to the Iraqis, the Bush administration appeared unable to recognize what was happening. Just a few hours after the destruction of the Askariya shrine, U.S. Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice appeared on Egyptian television. The interviewer, Mervat Mohsen, summed up the changes in Iraq from a Sunni perspective. "Excessive meddling has brought the Shiites in Iraq to power. The neighboring Iranians are Shia. The Sunnis are compromised. America's trusted Arab allies are Sunnis. There is a civil war brewing in Iraq. What have you done?" Rice insisted Iraq's political process was fully on track. "Well, I don't think there is a civil war brewing in Iraq. I think what you have in Iraq is a country that has thrown off the yoke of a horrible dictator, who, by the way, created all kinds of instability in this region with his wars against his neighbors. Now that that dictator is gone, you have the Iraqi people, who come from many different sects, from many different ethnic groups, trying to use a political process of compromise and politics to replace repression." With regard to Iraq, President Bush and his top advisers have consistently substituted wishful thinking for analysis and hope for strategy. In July 2004, the Central Intelligence Agency prepared a National Intelligence Estimate, NIE, of the situation in Iraq. Representing the collective judgment of America's most experienced Iraq analysts based on the best intelligence available to the U.S. government, the NIE warned of the danger of civil war. When President Bush was asked about the NIE in September 2004, he shrugged it off. "The CIA said life could be lousy, life could be okay, life could be better. The Iraqi people don't share their pessimism." On June 4, 2005, I attended the first session of the newly elected Kurdistan National Assembly in Erbil, northern Iraq. Among those attending was Iraq's president, Jalal Talabani. Talabani, a Kurd, is not only the first ever democratically elected head of state in Iraq, but in a country that traces its history back to the Garden of Eden, he is, as one friend observed, the first freely chosen leader of this land since Adam was here alone. While Kurds are enormously proud of his accomplishment, the flag of Iraq, the country Talabani heads, was noticeably absent from the inauguration ceremony, nor can it be found any place in Erbil, a city of 1 million that is the capital of Iraq's Kurdistan region. Anne Bodine, the head of the American Embassy office in Kirkuk, spoke at the ceremony, congratulating the newly minted parliamentarians and affirming the U.S. commitment to an Iraq that is, she said, democratic, federal, pluralist, and unified. The phrase evidently did not apply in Erbil. In their oath, the parliamentarians were asked to swear loyalty to the unity of the Kurdistan region of Iraq. Many pointedly dropped the "of Iraq." The shortest speech was given by the head of the Iranian intelligence service in Erbil, a man known to the Kurds as Agha Panayi. Looking directly at Ms. Bodin, he said simply, "This is a great day. Throughout Iraq, the people we supported are in power." He did not add, "Thank you, George Bush." The unstated was understood. Thanks to the American invasion, Kurdistan has consolidated its status as a virtually independent state, and in so doing has righted an historic wrong. Winston Churchill included the Kurds in Arab Iraq in 1921, when he was a cabinet minister in Lloyd George's coalition government, responsible for the Middle East. The Kurds rebelled against this decision through much of the 20th century. Iraq's military response to Kurdish opposition escalated over the decades, culminating with Saddam Hussein's genocidal Anfal campaign of the late 1980s, a campaign that included extensive use of poison gas on Kurdish villagers. Churchill considered the forced incorporation of the Kurds in Iraq as one of his biggest mistakes, and it is perhaps fitting that the mistake has been undone by an American president who keeps a bust of Churchill in the Oval Office. As Agha Panayi indicated in his speech, Iran has emerged as the major beneficiary of America's Iraq War. Ever since the Ottomans and Persians agreed in the Treaty of Kasr-Shirin to a demarcation line in 1639 between their two empires, the line that is now the Iran-Iraq border has separated the Persians from the Arabs and the Shiite-ruled lands from the Sunni-ruled. But since 2003, Iranian-sponsored Shiite religious parties have run Iraq's nine southern provinces, known as governorates, as well as Baghdad. The Shiite religious parties dominate Iraq's central government and control the interior ministry, which has enabled them to place Iranian-trained militiamen into the police. Iran has substantial influence over Iraq's U.S.-created military, and is developing economic ties that will soon link the two countries' strategically vital oil facilities. There is no small irony in these developments. As he began to prepare the American people for war with Iraq in his January 2002 State of the Union speech, President Bush denounced what he described as an axis of evil between Iraq and Iran, along with North Korea. At that time, there were no more bitter enemies than the Iran of the Ayatollahs and the Iraq of Saddam Hussein. Thanks to George W. Bush, Iran has no closer ally in the world than the Iraq of the Ayatollahs. This new Tehran-Baghdad axis could have revolutionary consequences for the Middle East. Iraq is now the Arab world's first Shiite-ruled state, and the Shiite victory in Iraq is bound to influence a Shiite-populated crescent that extends from southern Iraq into Saudi Arabia's eastern province, into Kuwait, and to Bahrain. This Shiite crescent sits atop the most important oil reservoirs in the world. As the United States entered the fourth year of occupying Iraq, it had 130,000 troops battling a Sunni Arab insurgency. Based in a community that is no more than 20% of Iraq's population, the Sunni Arab insurgents cannot prevail militarily. But they cannot readily be defeated either. The U.S. can clear insurgents out of Sunni cities, but it has insufficient forces to hold the territory. Pushed out of one area, the insurgents move to another and return when the Americans move on. Insurgency, civil war, Iranian strategic triumph, the breakup of Iraq, and independent Kurdistan, military quagmire. These are all consequences of the American invasion of Iraq that the Bush administration failed to anticipate. About some of these things, such as the Sunni Arab insurgency, the president and his top advisers have admitted they were surprised. About others, they are in denial. In his 2006 State of the Union address, President Bush said, "Hindsight is not wisdom, and second-guessing is not a strategy." It is, of course, understandable why the president prefers not to look back. It isn't that he failed to consider some possible adverse consequences of the war. but rather that he missed all of them. In devising strategy, one can hope for the best, but should be prepared for the worst. The Bush administration hoped that American troops would be greeted as liberators and that Iraqis would embrace democracy. Yet it had no contingency plans to follow in case it didn't work out that way. Some of the outcomes in Iraq are the inevitable result of the invasion. Iraq was cobbled together by the British at the end of World War I from three different Ottoman Vilayets, or provinces, predominantly Kurdish Mosul in the north, mostly Sunni Baghdad at the center, and Shiite Basra in the south. The Arab parts of the country had a shared identity, but the Kurds wanted no part of the new state. The British installed a foreign Sunni Arab prince, Faisal of Hejaz, as Iraq's king in 1921. He and his successors ruled through a Sunni Arab-dominated bureaucracy and military. In 1958, the Iraqi military overthrew the monarchy, gunning down Faisal's grandson, the young King Faisal II, but continued the Sunni Arab domination of the country. In order to rule over the 55% of Iraqis who are Shiite and the 20% who are Kurdish, Iraq's Sunni Arab rulers used varying degrees of force to stay in power. In 2003, the United States ousted the last and most brutal of Iraq's Sunni Arab dictators. It smashed Iraq's army and then legally dissolved the Iraqi military, security services, and Ba'ath Party. The army and secret police were the institutions that had enabled Iraq's Sunni Arab minority to rule for 80 years. With these repressive institutions gone, Iraq's Shiite majority took power through democratic elections in 2005 and asserted sectarian control over key institutions, including the police. In the constitutional negotiations in August 2005, the Kurds consolidated the independence they always wanted. The Sunni Arabs resented bitterly their loss of historic hegemony and violently resisted a Shiite-dominated new order. Civil war was always a possible, if not likely, outcome. The only remarkable thing is that it caught the Bush administration by surprise. The Bush administration assumed the transition from Saddam Hussein's Sunni Arab dictatorship to a stable new order in Iraq would be easy. So easy, in fact, that no real planning would be required. Many of the United States' present difficulties in Iraq are the direct consequence of the failure to plan for the day after U.S. troops entered Baghdad. The professional military had wanted to send more troops to secure Iraq than the Pentagon's civilian leaders were willing to commit. But even with the troops it did have in Iraq, the United States could have protected Iraq's government ministries and its most important national institutions, including the Archaeological Museum, had there been a plan to do so. During 8 critical weeks after Saddam fell, U.S. authority in Iraq ebbed away as looters demolished the capital city's public institutions, and it became clear that the U.S. military was unwilling or unable to maintain order. The catastrophe was followed by a 14-month occupation that was mismanaged from start to finish. The president did not decide whether to turn power over to an interim Iraqi government or to have the United States run the country in the manner of the post-war occupations of Germany and Japan. For a month after the fall of Baghdad, the administration pursued both policies simultaneously. When Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld chose an administrator for Iraq, he picked a retired diplomat with no experience of the country and gave him 2 weeks to prepare for the assignment. The administrator, L. Paul Bremer III, decided after 3 days in Iraq that he, not the Iraqis, would run the country. The result was a bungled effort at nation-building that was characterized by ineffective administration, constantly shifting political direction, an inability to restore essential services, including electricity, economic decline, mismanagement of billions of dollars in Iraqi and U.S. funds, corruption, and a failed effort to build a new Iraqi military and police. The Bush administration's grand ambitions for Iraq were undone by arrogance, ignorance, and political cowardice. In not preparing for the collapse of law and order, the administration ignored the warnings of experts and of Iraqis, and seemed to assume that Iraq's police and bureaucrats would report for work the day after Saddam fell. This coincided with its unwillingness to take the politically difficult decision to deploy sufficient troops, and to give those it did send responsibility for maintaining law and order. While attempting a breathtakingly bold effort at nation-building, the administration relied on the judgments of inexperienced and unqualified staff instead of those who actually knew something about the country. In my recent trips to Iraq, I have asked its elected political leaders where they thought the United States went wrong. All gave the same answer: when the United States became an occupier instead of a liberator. In short, when the Bush administration decided it was more capable of determining Iraq's future than the peoples of the country itself. President Bush speaks of Iraq as integral to a larger struggle for freedom in the Middle East. In the run-up to the war, Vice President Richard Cheney and the civilians in charge at the Pentagon, Rumsfeld, Deputy Secretary Paul Wolfowitz, Undersecretary for Policy Douglas Feith, advocated the war because it was central to their radical ambition to remake the Middle East into pro-Western, market-oriented democracies that would have good relations with one another and with Israel. Iraq was to trigger a domino effect, with Iran and Syria the next to fall. For this to work, the Bush administration's visionaries had to make certain assumptions about how Iraq's Shiite majority would behave after taking power. Wolfowitz theorized that Iraq's Shiites would oppose a clerical state and develop a pro-Western polity that could actually undermine the Ayatollahs in Iran. This scenario ignored some inconvenient facts. Iran has supported Iraq's Shiites for decades, funding their political parties and training and equipping their militias. Iraq's largest Shiite party, the Supreme Council for the Islamic Revolution in Iraq, SCIRI, was founded under Iranian auspices in Tehran in 1982. Its name provides a clue as to its political agenda. A war undertaken in part to undermine Iran's Islamic Republic has given Tehran its greatest strategic gain in four centuries. In justifying the war, President Bush proclaimed that the United States of America will not permit the world's most dangerous regimes to threaten us with the world's most destructive weapons. Iraq did not have weapons of mass destruction, WMD. But with U.S. attention and resources committed to Iraq, both North Korea and Iran have been free to pursue their nuclear weapons programs. As the U.S. made preparations in 2002 and 2003 for the Iraq War, North Korea expelled United Nations nuclear inspectors, withdrew from the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and reprocessed previously safeguarded plutonium into material for nuclear weapons. The president loudly insisted that the United States would not tolerate a nuclear-armed North Korea, and did precisely nothing. At the beginning of 2006, Iran announced it would enrich uranium that can be used for a nuclear weapon. With U.S. forces tied down in Iraq, the Iranians could feel confident that there would be no American response. Muqtada al-Sadr warned, "If neighboring Islamic countries, including Iran, become the target of attacks, we will support them. The Mahdi army is beyond the Iraqi army. It was established to defend Islam." This is no idle threat. During a 2004 uprising against the U.S. occupation, the Mahdi army so disrupted American supply lines in Iraq that Bremer nearly had to impose food rationing on the thousands of Americans working in his occupation government in Baghdad. The Mahdi...
Sample complete. Ready to continue?